Everybody remembers the scene in The Godfather where Don Corleone tells the frightened Undertaker that he will take vengeance for his daughter, but that if he did so, the Undertaker would be in his debt. There is something undeniably terrifying about the scene, the way that the Don speaks of justice, even as he's speaking of torture and mutilation, the suggestion that in entering his world, one abandons the very possibility of a justice that could be based on anything else. It is an interesting fact that gangsters, who are businessmen, who base their trade on violence, will almost invariably frame what they do in terms of debt. They begin to develop a network of people who owe them minor favors. To deliver a package, for example, or let them keep something in their house. Gradually, they broker such favors into greater wealth, greater power, greater debts. Don Corleone represents the pinnacle of such a system, but there is also something in that scene that embodies something deep and essential about the experience of being in debt. That combination of morality and menace in the creditor, since, after all, if there's anything more terrifying than being the object of violence, it's being the object of justified violence. And that combination of fear, shame, but also indignation that characterizes the debtor. That tension, the feeling that debt embodies the essence of morality, but at the same time, the feeling that there is something deeply, profoundly unjust about it, recurs again and again throughout human history. Wherever one looks, in all times and places, one finds two things that almost everyone agrees with. One is that morality is a matter of paying one's debts. The other is that those who are in the habit of lending money for a living are evil. According to ancient Buddhist thought, a debtor who did not pay would be reborn as a slave or an ox in the household of his creditor. However, we also find tales of karmic revenge against usurers who went too far. A medieval Japanese author recounts a story he swears to be true of the reincarnation of a greedy lender called Hiromushime, which occurred 7 days after her death.
Those who came to look at her encountered an indescribable stench. From the waist up, she had already become an ox, with 4-inch horns protruding from her forehead. Her two hands had become the hooves of an ox. Her nails were now cracked so that they resembled an ox hoof's instep. From the waist down, however, her body was that of a human. She disliked rice and preferred to eat grass. Her manner of eating was rumination. Naked, she would lie in her own excrement. Gawkers descended. Guilty and ashamed, the family made desperate attempts to buy forgiveness, cancelling all debts owed to them by anybody, donating much of their wealth to religious establishments. Finally, mercifully, the monster died.
The fact is, whenever we think about debt, we seem to end up in a deep moral confusion. We think that debts must be paid, and yet we despise debt itself. Religious historian Martin Palmer.
Because debt has become so focused on finance, and because finance has become the preserve of an ever smaller and smaller section of society, and that section of society not only manages the financial side, but to a very considerable degree manages the political side of our life, it now carries with it connotations of exploitation, connotations of unjust levels of debt, of unaccountable levels of interest, and of a sense that we are trapped in something over which we have remarkably little control and where there is a remarkable lack of morality. And therefore, it has become, if you like, a lightning rod, not just for financial anxieties and concerns, but concerns about the direction, the political, the social, the ecological direction of society.
Debt is everywhere. Almost everyone we know is in debt in one way or another. Modern consumer economies run on debt. Modern nation-states operate on deficit financing. The last 30 or 40 years have seen the gradual creation of what can only be described as a kind of global debt bureaucracy. A few years ago, this system came very near to collapsing, with terrible results. Debt informs everything we do, yet nobody really understands it. When I first set out to grapple with the problem of what debt is, I found that no one had ever written a history of debt. There are plenty of histories of, say, banking or of economic thought, and scholars seem to produce an endless stream of histories of money. But even books that purport to be histories of money rarely have much to say about credit arrangements. They almost always turn out not to be histories of money at all, but histories of coinage. Money, in fact, is just a means of exchange. Reading most of them, one would have no way of knowing that in reality, throughout human history, the overwhelming majority of monetary transactions were on credit. So I set out to write a history of debt. In doing so, I discovered things that completely upended almost all received understandings of economic history. Even our most basic assumptions about the nature of money, for example, are simply wrong. In this series, I will reveal that debt actually precedes the invention of money, and that the history of both money and debt is also a history of war and violence. Yet, in the midst of all this bloody history, the other theme that jumps out again and again is the deep and abiding moral power of the idea of debt. On one level, the reasons for this moral power might seem obvious. A debt is a promise. Typically, a debt is a promise to pay a certain amount of money, according to certain conditions, often at a certain rate of interest, by a certain time. It's easy to see why a promise might be considered sacred. You could even make the argument that, in a certain sense at least, that's all that human society really is, a series of promises we make to one another. But if so, why is it that we tend to treat certain kinds of promises as more sacred than others? Because there's no doubt that debts are regularly treated this way. Martin Palmer again.
If one was to look at the biblical root of the notion of debt, of a kind of covenant between the one who has power and the ones who do not, you'd need to go back to Noah. Because Noah has a covenant with God following the flood. Because Noah, frankly, is in God's debt. Where there is a covenant relationship, whether that's with God or with a bank, because we religiously associate such covenants with God, we've actually given almost a sacred dimension to the obligation of debt. I mean, a very simple indicator of this is look at any 18th or 19th century facade of a bank in any high street, in any town or city of Britain, and you will see that they built them to look like temples. Why? Because they knew they were playing with the notion of a sacred covenant of obligation, that they were playing on the notion of God's agreement with us, God's remission of our debts, but also the sense of a covenant with God. And that's why, and it's quite remarkable, look at any serious bank building. It looks like a temple.
Politicians in countries like Great Britain or other democratic countries quite often get elected on the basis of campaign promises to provide free higher education, for example, or public services of some other kind. Sometimes they swear solemn oaths. Often after their election, they announce that they cannot actually keep these promises because there's just not enough money. That is, because of the need to make regular payments on the national debt. But what are they really saying? They're saying a promise to repay bondholders at a certain agreed rate of interest is more sacred than a promise made to the electorate, and everyone seems to accept this. Why is that? Well, if you ask most political commentators, they'll say the answer is obvious. If governments didn't keep their promises to creditors, creditors would be less inclined to lend, and the economy would suffer. But you could just as easily make the same argument the other way. If politicians didn't keep their promises to voters, citizens would be less inclined to vote, and democracy would suffer. And in fact, this is precisely what we do observe. So why is it that we assume that when politicians make promises to voters, these promises are made to be broken, but when they make promises to bondholders, they are not? Call this the paradox of debt. Nobody likes Don Corleone, but we are still somehow convinced that he is in the right. We may hate and fear our creditors, but somehow we still believe that deadbeats are, in moral terms, even worse. That's why mafiosi always frame even pure extortion in terms of debt. For thousands of years, violent men have been able to tell their victims that those victims owe them something. If nothing else, they owe them their lives, a telling phrase, because they haven't killed them. As a result, arguments about debt have been going on for at least 5,000 years, from when we first see debts recorded in cuneiform in ancient Mesopotamia. For most of human history, most human beings have been told that they are debtors. Historians, and particularly historians of ideas, have been oddly reluctant to consider the human consequences, especially since this situation, more than any other, has caused continual outrage and resentment, because this is the other thing that history reveals. Ordinarily, it is indeed possible to make relations of power more palatable by addressing the mob in the language of debt. But when the trick fails, it tends to fail spectacularly. For thousands of years, the struggle between rich and poor has largely taken the form of conflicts between creditors and debtors. By the same token, for the last 5,000 years, with remarkable regularity, popular insurrections have begun the same way, with the ritual destruction of the debt records. Most of the great revolutionary movements of history began as debt revolts. From the debtors' rebellions that produced the Athenian or Roman constitutions to the turmoil of the Arab Spring. What we are going to do in this series is to trace the outlines of this history, a history that could not have more profound implications for the politics of the present day. So, what exactly is a debt? It might seem that the answer is perfectly simple. A debt is a promise by one person to pay another person a certain amount of money, usually under certain specified terms and conditions, at some point in the future. Certainly, when we ordinarily talk about debt, I owe the bank £1,000, for instance, this is what we mean. We also speak of other kinds of debt.
Debts of gratitude.
Debts of honor.
Debts of kindness.
Debts to society.
These are debts that clearly have nothing to do with money. It would be easy to write them all off as simple metaphors. They're not really debts. They just resemble them in some way. But a moment's reflection reveals it's not actually that simple. Think of the scene in The Godfather in which Don Corleone promises to take revenge upon the men who raped the Undertaker's daughter. In that case, no promise had been made. No money had changed hands, and the terms and conditions were completely unspecified. Yet, clearly, the whole point of the episode was that the Undertaker was, most definitely, in Don Corleone's debt. So the next step is to say, well, maybe any sense of owing anybody anything is a debt. This rapidly leads to the conclusion that debt really is the basis of all morality. The logic here runs as follows. Really, all interactions between two human beings are forms of exchange.
Let me give you something.
Well, I must give you something back.
Well, now we're even. Let's call it quits.
Or, if they're still not even, there's a debt. By this logic, the Don's rough justice might be crude, but that's all that justice ever really is. However we might dress it up, it all comes down to the law of tit for tat, an eye for an eye, or, in happier circumstances, one good turn deserves another. Now, there's no denying that much of human life really does operate on tit for tat principles. Neither is there any doubt that a good number of social scientists are convinced that it is possible to reduce everything we do to exchange, and that all morality is based on the principle of reciprocity. But there are also plenty of examples that simply can't be reduced to that logic, no matter how hard we try. Let me give an example. In the last century, European missionaries in unfamiliar parts of the world were often confused to discover that there are places in the world where, if one saves someone's life, one actually ends up owing the person one saved. This account is from a Reverend W.H. Beatley.
A day or two after we reached Varna, we found one of the natives very ill with pneumonia. Komba treated him and kept him alive on strong fowl soup. A great deal of careful nursing and attention was visited on him, for his house was beside the camp. When we were ready to go on our way again, the man was well. To our astonishment, he came and asked us for a present, and was as astonished and disgusted as he had made us to be when we declined giving it. We suggested that it was his place to bring us a present and to show some gratitude. He said to us, "Well, indeed, you white men have no shame."
We have no way of knowing what was really going on in the mind of the patient in this story, but it is possible to come up with a scenario where this sort of behavior might make sense. Let's imagine that we are dealing with a place where, if one man saves another's life, the two become like brothers. They are absolute equals and are expected to share everything and to provide for one another when each is in need. If so, the patient would surely notice that his new brother appeared to be extraordinarily wealthy, not in much need of anything, but that he, the patient, was lacking in many things that the missionary could provide. Or let's imagine another scenario, more likely, actually. Imagine there was a tradition that if you save someone's life, you become exactly the opposite of equals. You are now your savior's loyal retainer, and will recognize his superiority and greatness for the rest of your life. But clients are always asking favors from their patrons. The problem in this case was the missionary didn't know he would have been able to make unlimited demands of his new retainer, too. Just different kinds. To mind his sheep, to run messages, perhaps to attack his enemies. In other words, there are two possible principles that might apply to transactions between human beings. Not just material transactions, but moral interactions of any sort that have nothing to do with reciprocity. I'll be provocative and call the first one communism. By this I mean not the sort of system that prevailed in countries controlled by communist parties, but simply the principle of from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. Debts require the calculation of who owes what to whom. But when transactions take place according to this first principle, no one keeps account. We simply don't bother. Most of us treat our best friends and closest family that way, but if you think about it, this principle applies in all sorts of contexts. If several people are working on a common task, it doesn't matter if they're working for a community center or if they're working for British Petrol. If one says,
"Can you hand me that wrench?"
the other does not say,
"Oh yeah? And what do I get for that?"
They apply the principle of from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs because it's the most efficient way to get the job done. Finally, within every society, there's a level of what I'd call baseline communism, where if the cost is small enough...
Do you have a light?
Or if the need is great enough...
I'm drowning.
Even strangers will be expected to operate on similar principles. There's never been a society that operates entirely on communistic principles, and it's hard to imagine how there ever could be. Still, it lies at the foundation of all human sociability. Even those things we enjoy the most involve a sort of communism of the senses. The sharing of music, food, liquor, drugs, gossip, drama, beds, and it does not involve reciprocity. Hierarchical relations, where one party is explicitly superior to another, don't tend to work on the basis of reciprocity either. They work on a logic of precedent. If you give money to a beggar, or sweets to a child, they are very unlikely to give you money or sweets back. They might well expect you to give them the same thing again. I gave money to the United Farm Workers Union once, and I never heard the end of it. In medieval Europe, all this was quite formalized and explicit. The great medieval historian Mark Bloch wrote,
"In the 9th century, at Ardres, we are told, there was once a bear, the property of the local lord. The inhabitants, who loved to watch it fight with dogs, undertook to feed it. The beast eventually died, but the lord continued to exact the loaves of bread."
There were, in fact, documents called writs of non-prejudice. One would have to convince one's lord to sign in order to avoid this eventuality. To say, just because I gave you this once, it doesn't mean I have to give it to you again. Finally, in addition to communism and hierarchy, there's a third principle to consider, and this is, indeed, exchange. Exchange is temporary. Whether it's a gift exchange or a cash transaction, it's a simple matter of tit for tat. Objects change hands, favors are dispensed, and when it's over, both parties can walk away as equals once again. A debt, in contrast, exists when such an arrangement is not complete. It occurs within relations between people who are at least formal equals, or at the very least, who treat each other as equals, when a transaction has not been cancelled out, and they cannot walk away from one another. This helps explain why debt is, in so many languages, a synonym for guilt or sin. One is in debt if one didn't do something one really ought to have done, if one has done something wrong. And it's precisely this which gives debt its remarkable moral power. There is a final element to bear in mind when defining debt. A debt is an obligation which can be quantified. One can specify exactly what is owed. This has the advantage that one can know precisely when one has paid it. But it has further effects. It means a debt is now impersonal and transferable. If someone promises to meet you for drinks or to take care of your ailing mother, you can't pass that promise on to someone else. But if they promise to pay you 5 sheep or 20 quid, you can. Normally, debts are between equals. But if two people really are equals, if there's a crisis or unforeseen circumstance, you can always renegotiate the deal. It's only when the contract is between people who are in no sense equals, you and your bank, for instance, that the powerful party can treat the obligation as absolute. This, however, requires the use of money. So, what is money? One would imagine nothing is so obvious. Yet, oddly enough, there's no consensus, even among economists, about what money actually is. Keith Hart is professor of economic anthropology at the London School of Economics.
There are many different ways of defining money, but for me, money is a source of collective and individual memory, a way of tracing our relations with people. We have large numbers of financial relations, property relations, asset relations, insurance contributions, and so on. And money is an extremely convenient way of keeping track of what we're spending on these things and what we owe. And of course, money is also a kind of measure of status in the community. And not everything that matters to us can be measured in this way, but it's a very convenient way of organizing and remembering some of the things that do matter.
Keith's is one definition. You'll also frequently hear that money is
a means of exchange,
a measure of value,
a store of value,
a means of payment,
a means of account.
All this boils down to a basic dilemma. Is money merely an abstraction, an accounting technique, a way of saying 5 of these things equal 6 of those? Or is it primarily an object, a commodity, a physical thing that passes from hand to hand? And is it possible it could really be both at the same time? Economists have invented a story that makes it seem plausible. The story originates from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, but we all know it. Just ask anyone where money originally comes from. We've all heard the tale 1,000 times before.
Once upon a time, there was no money, so everyone had to make do with barter. People would simply swap things directly with one another. Tell you what, I'll give you 20 chickens for that cow. And prices could be negotiated by supply and demand.
But, according to Adam Smith, as society grew more complicated, this system of barter created obvious problems. What if I want to trade with you? I have only cows to exchange, but you don't need any cows at the moment. In contemporary economics, This problem has come to be known as the double coincidence of wants. For barter to work, both parties need to want what the other is offering, which, frankly, is a coincidence too far. To find a permanent solution to the problem, you need a commodity that's both easily exchangeable and universally desired. The following story appears in every economics textbook.
First, people settled on gold and silver, which had the advantage of being portable, durable, divisible, and homogeneous in quality. As barter gave way to metal, so did metal to coins, coins to paper money to credit arrangements, and before you know it, you have compounded interest rates, virtual currencies, and collateralized debt obligations.
But there's a basic problem with this account. It simply isn't true. In fact, nothing like this ever happened. Ever since The Wealth of Nations was published in 1776, explorers, travelers, and anthropologists have fanned out across the world, trying to find a place where everyday economic transactions really do take the form of, I'll give you 20 chickens for that cow. To this day, they have never found one. Anthropologist Keith Hartigan.
The anthropological evidence is that nobody has ever discovered barter on any systematic level anywhere. Barter never has preceded money. It's fairly clear that it is possible to develop quite complicated financial systems based on the organization and calculation of debt. And if you look at Mesopotamia in the 3rd millennium BC, the evidence is strongly in favor of that. You look at the early financial instruments of clay tablets and so on, they're simply marking, saying 3 pots of grain worth so much to somebody else. And that becomes a kind of a marker of, I mean, you can call it debt if you like, but it's just that it's an account. And these accounts do not need a medium of exchange.
This might seem surprising in itself, since the variety of forms of exchange anthropologists actually did encounter was really quite dazzling. But nowhere did they find neighbors swapping arrowheads for beaver pelts. But if you think about it, is this really so surprising? Economists have repeated the same barter story over and over without apparently noticing that it makes no sort of sense. Because the underlying assumption is that neighbors, even in a small community like a Neolithic village, will deal with each other only in what economists call the spot trade.
I shall give you this beaver pelt.
And I shall give you these arrowheads.
Perfect. And now let's go our separate ways. Transaction over.
Economists suppose that if these two can't do a spot trade, they won't do anything at all. But this is absurd. Imagine a real Neolithic village. Say you wish to acquire one of your neighbor's cows to kill at a funeral.
I would very much like that cow of yours to kill at my uncle's funeral.
I see, but you don't have anything I need at this moment in time.
Does this mean a transaction is impossible? Of course not. After all, they're probably going to be living next to each other for the next 30 years. Certainly, you're going to have something your neighbor wants eventually. And anyway, it's just generally useful to have neighbors in your debt. So one walks up to the other and says,
I would very much like that cow of yours to kill at my uncle's funeral.
To which the other responds,
Really? Well, it's not much. But tell you what, just take it. It's a present. And don't even think about giving me anything in return. We're neighbors and we love each other. The cow's on me.
But of course, really, now everyone knows the villager that has been given the cow is in his neighbor's debt. And someday he might return and say,
My, that's an excellent canoe you have. I would just love to have it.
Or even,
I've never mentioned this, but my son is in love with your daughter.
This might seem fanciful, but when anthropologists settle down in small-scale communities, almost anywhere, this is pretty much exactly what we find. Everyday items like staple foods and tobacco may be shared freely, but with dealings between neighbors, when it comes to important things, we find a web of debts. These debts are not denominated in currency, even where currency does exist. What emerges instead is a rough set of equivalences. A cow is sort of like a canoe, whereas something like a bowl would not be sufficient in exchange for a greenstone axe. If so, the real question when it comes to the origin of money is, how does this sort of rough set of equivalences, I owe you one, turn into a precise system of accounting? The answer has been right in front of us all along. All we have to do is to take a look at, say, medieval Welsh or Irish law codes. They often contain detailed descriptions of the exact cash value of every item likely to be found in an average person's household, from the plates to the bedding to the roof beams on the shed. Yet most of these things could not actually be bought or sold in markets. In fact, during much of this period, markets simply did not exist. These exact values were, in fact, needed to pay fines and compensation. All we need to do is use our imagination, and it becomes easy to see why this should be the case. If you feel someone who owes you a favor is being a cheapskate, you are unlikely to come up with a mathematical formula to determine just how cheap you think they are. But imagine a drunken quarrel takes place, in which someone's tooth or eye is knocked out. Well, that's quite another matter. Even societies lacking in states or markets will tend to have very elaborate schedules of fines and compensations for exactly how many sheep or how many silver plates one must pay in compensation for a missing body part or a disfiguring scar. The following is a reading from a Welsh medieval law code.
A person's hand and his foot and his eye and his lip and his ear with loss of hearing and his nose, 6 kine and 6 score of silver is the worth of each of them. If a person's ear be wholly cut off, and the person continue to hear as before, 2 kine and 2 score of silver are to be paid.
These are important because, otherwise, things might descend into further violence, and eventually into blood feuds. This is why the English word to pay is originally derived from a word for to pacify or to appease, as in, to give someone something precious, to express just how bad you feel about having just harmed his brother in a drunken brawl. This is precisely the situation in which people are likely to be the most exacting, and also the least willing to compromise. The law says 10 sheep. What if I don't have any sheep? Will chickens do? If so, they had better be exactly the right number of chickens. And if not chickens, what else could we substitute? It's easy to see how something like the Welsh or Irish law codes, with their price systems, measuring everything against the value of silver, would be the inevitable result. In other words, in a situation fraught with violence and the danger of a blood feud, the scenario imagined by the economists might actually occur. Through such mechanisms, money could, and undoubtedly did, develop as a way to measure debts. The true origin of money lies in the need to provide an exact equivalent for what you owe someone who might otherwise be inclined to kill you. Money first emerged not from peaceful trade, but from legal systems as a way to measure debts. This seems like a very practical solution to a problem, but it makes it all the more curious that the language of debt is also, in the ancient world, very much the language of religion. Think of our current religious terminology.
Sin.
Forgiveness.
Reckoning.
Redemption.
All of these words actually derive from the language of ancient finance. What's more, this seems to be true in all the great religious traditions. Not just Judaism and Christianity, but Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and Islam. We tend to think of these religions as teaching us that we must repay our debts. But the truth is that the financial metaphors in religious texts are oddly ambivalent. Let us take a famous example. We all know the Lord's Prayer.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.
Actually, this is the 1559 Anglican Book of Common Prayer translation. Its original and more accurate translation, by John Wycliffe in 1381, preserved in the King James edition, reads,
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors.
What's so striking about the Lord's Prayer is that it's not entirely clear what it actually means. Forgive us our debts, just as we forgive those who owe us money. Do we, in fact, forgive those who owe us money? Actually, most of us don't. So what is the prayer actually saying? That God should forgive us anyway? It's certainly true that the great religions talk about the forgiveness of debts more than the repayment of debts. To understand what's really happening here, we need to understand the social context of the times in which these religions emerged. These were times when the cancellation of debts was commonplace. The usual story we are told in economics textbooks, that first there was barter, then there was money, then finally credit, is not really true. Actually, it's backwards. Credit arrangements come first. Physical currency was invented later. All evidence we have indicates that the first civilizations of the ancient Middle East were credit economies. They were based on what we would now call virtual money. That is, there was no physical currency. Markets did exist, but they operated on credit. Every 6 months to a year, particularly around harvest time, customers would come into the local tavern and pay their tab, or reimburse local merchants with sacks of grain or other goods. The problem is, what would happen when the harvests were bad? Peasants would fall into arrears. They'd need even greater loans, using their flocks and fields and vineyards as collateral. And if they began to lose those too, they fell into a credit trap. Interest accumulated, and before long, members of their family would begin to be taken away. Some might be kept as servants. Others might be turned out as prostitutes in the temples, or were sold abroad as slaves. As one might imagine, this caused significant unrest. Debtors fled to the deserts, often joining nomadic bands that threatened to overwhelm the cities. Rulers such as Nehemiah, when he returned to Judea in the 5th century BC, appointed by the Persian king to rebuild Jerusalem, could expect to encounter organized protests. The following reading is from the book of Nehemiah.
Some also there were that said, "We have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses, that we might buy corn because of the dearth." There were also those that said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tribute, and that upon our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants, and some of our daughters are brought unto bondage already. Neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards." And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and said unto them, "Ye exact usury, every one of his brother." And I set a great assembly against them.
The usual response was debt cancellation. As early as the 3rd millennium BC, it had become standard practice for every new king coming to power in a Sumerian city to issue a decree of debt freedom, declaring all existing obligations null and void. In Judea, after Nehemiah, such blank slates were institutionalized. Every 7th year was declared a year of jubilee. All debts were forgiven. All those in debt peonage were released. These ancient practices of debt forgiveness are still present in Judaism. Religious historian Martin Palmer.
In Judaism, every 7 years, in a Shemitah year, you are expected to forgive the debts, and every 50 years, all debts are wiped out in a Jubilee year, which is why when there was a campaign to get the World Bank to allow the countries that had gone into deep debt, the developing countries, to be clear of debt, it was called the Jubilee Movement.
All the talk in the Bible of reckoning, redemption, and judgment can only be understood in this light. As we see from the text from Nehemiah, arguments about debt and morality, justice and injustice, were on everybody's lips. They were clearly the stock and trade of everyday political argument. But one thing that is always true of such arguments, they have a tendency to grow. The moment a conquering king imposes tribute on the grounds that you owe him your life because he didn't kill you, and you find yourself losing your daughter to a creditor, it's very hard not to respond, "Now, wait a minute. Who owes what to whom here?" Don't we provide our rulers with everything? And what do they owe us? But the moment you do that, the language of debt actually expands. It comes to embrace everything. And this is precisely the situation we encounter in all the great religious texts. In Hinduism, for example, this expansion is realized in the form of the three debts. Chakravarti Ramprasad is a professor of comparative religion and philosophy at Lancaster University.
The three debts are to the gods, to the seers and teachers, and finally to the ancestors. The debt to the gods is paid through the life of upper caste males by sacrifice. The debt to the seers is through learning the sacred texts, the Vedas. The debt to the forefathers or the ancestors is paid through having children, in the later commentaries, specifically sons.
A moment's reflection shows these debts are not repaid in the traditional sense. In fact, the last two debts involve not repaying, but becoming your creditor. You repay the seers by learning wisdom and becoming more like a seer yourself. And you repay your ancestors by becoming a parent and thus becoming an ancestor of future generations. So what about the first debt, our primordial debt to the gods? Chakravarti Ramprasad again.
The debt to the gods is in some sense an outlining of our relationship to reality, to cosmos as a whole. Because in the Vedic understanding, the gods represent the various aspects of cosmic order, the forces of natural order. So to that extent, the debt to them is really a debt for our very existence and for our continued life. It means that the very fact of our existence is something we owe to the universe.
If in all the other cases, one repays the debt by becoming one's creditor, isn't the implication that paying one's debts to the gods or to the cosmos is ultimately the same thing? Is not the text ultimately suggesting what would be more ridiculous than to imagine it is possible to pay your debts to the cosmos? That would mean that you and the cosmos, which is, after all, everything that has ever existed and ever will exist, including yourself, are somehow equal parties to a business deal. It's only when we realize that we are one with the cosmos, because we are part of the cosmos, that the very idea of owing becomes meaningless, and the debt thus disappears. Certainly, this is the direction taken by much later Hindu thought, and it is worthwhile to think about. Whenever one speaks of a debt to society, or for that matter, a debt to nature, we are part of society, just as we are part of nature. In a way, we are forgetting that the moment we begin to speak of debt. This is a pattern. Again and again, the ancient religious texts begin by suggesting that morality is simply a matter of paying our debts, and then immediately reject the idea. If we return to the Bible, we find that the notion of absolute debt to the cosmos really lies behind the ambiguity we saw at the heart of the original Lord's Prayer. Martin Palmer again.
Now, at one level, you could argue that the morality is that you repay your debts, and that's pretty fundamental. But there is a greater morality, which is that you actually forgive those who have debts against you. You cut the obligation in order to give people more possibility. God has sought in Christ to reach out to you, to reconcile you to him, and he is wiping clean your debts. If God has done that, then you have an obligation to do that back as well. It doesn't mean that you never expect anybody to repay your debts, but you do acknowledge that there will be times when you need to let it go.
What's interesting here is that the great religious texts utilize the language of debt. Perhaps that's because it was the only language that was available. They, in effect, begin by saying, yes, morality is simply a matter of paying one's debts. However, The deeper understanding that these texts offer is that debt is an illusion, and that it is the annihilation of debt that is ultimately divine. We are taught that barter comes first, then currency, and only later credit. The historical record reveals that this is in fact a myth. Things actually proceeded precisely the other way around. Credit comes first. Interest rates are already documented in ancient Sumer, some 2,402 years before the birth of Christ. Currency, in contrast, and by this I mean coinage, actual pieces of valuable metal, stamped or cut or hammered into uniform denominations so that they can be used to buy and sell things, only appears almost 2,000 years later. The results were profoundly significant. The adoption of physical money and the resultant emergence of cash as opposed to credit markets completely transformed not only popular conceptions of debt and of what people owed to one another, it transformed our very conception of reality itself. Richard Seifert is a professor of ancient Greek at the University of Exeter.
The fact is that philosophy emerges apparently independently in Greece, in India and in China at about the same time.
That's around the 6th century BC.
Those are the three societies in the world which are being monetized by virtue of the invention and adoption of coinage. And for me, that can't be a coincidence. Now, to see how this works, we have to recognize how pre-modern societies imagine the cosmos in terms of society. Being without telescopes and laboratories, all that they have when they're trying to imagine cosmic power is power over society.
The Greeks believed that the world was ruled by Zeus, the perfect image of a bearded patriarchal monarch. But 600 BC Ionia, the birthplace of Greek philosophy, was no longer ruled by monarchs, and the invention of coinage at that time triggered a radically new worldview. Richard Seifert again.
What is beginning to happen there is something with which we are now quite familiar. The most powerful thing in the world is money. And so some Ionians start to imagine the cosmos in terms of money, unconsciously projecting onto the cosmos this strange, new, universally powerful thing that can be exchanged from and into all goods and services. So the first Greek philosophers all imagine that the cosmos consists of a single powerful substance. It might be air or fire or water, which is transformed from and into everything else. This is a cosmic projection of money, I believe, and it represents a radical break with all previous thinking. The world is no longer governed by the personal will or whims of gods or goddesses or demons, but is a single system subject to the uniformity of impersonal power.
But why did coinage emerge? Clearly not because it was in any sense useful for trade. People had been trading for millennia perfectly well without it. In the ancient Mediterranean, the great trading nations like the Phoenicians and Carthaginians were among the last to mint coins. And significantly, when they did, it was as a way of paying soldiers. The spread of coinage had enormous political and intellectual consequences. It was invented on the fringes of military operations, whether in Greece, India, or China, but was quickly taken up by enterprising kingdoms, some of which gradually gobbled up their neighbors. Eventually, vast empires emerged. The Athenian, Hellenistic, and Roman empires, Magadha, Nanda, the Chin, the Han. Armies are expensive to run, and in the end, we witness a cycle of violence and repayment in coinage. Richard Seifert again.
In order to get hold of all the gold and silver that there might be in sanctuaries or palaces, what you'd have to do would be to raise an army, sack the sanctuaries and the palaces. You then got a lot of gold and silver, and of course, you then are required to distribute it to your troops in small portions, because that's why the troops joined you in the first place. This dynamic of acquiring gold and silver through military force and then rewarding the people that have enabled you to do that, and thereby putting these bits of gold and silver in circulation was a dynamic that lasted through long phases of antiquity.
Whilst coinage was invented to pay soldiers, it was through taxation that it became embedded in the lives of entire populations. Empires are, invariably, based on a principle of taxation, that everyone who lives under their power does, indeed, owe a kind of debt to the sovereign. And not only that, subjects had to pay taxes in coinage minted by the empire itself. Why this happened has been considered something of an historical mystery. If Adam Smith was right and gold and silver naturally became money because they were useful for trade, then why didn't kings just seize control of the mines and keep all the money for themselves? They would have had all the money they wanted. Why did they take the metal, stamp their picture on it, distribute it around their empires, and only then demand that their subjects proceed to give them some back again to pay their taxes? Put it in these terms, and the whole enterprise doesn't make a lot of sense. However, it makes a great deal of sense if you're dealing with the problem of how to feed an army. Under ancient conditions, keeping, say, 50,000 men supplied with provisions was an extremely challenging undertaking. Leave them in one place, they'd probably consume everything edible within walking distance in a matter of weeks. Unless you want to employ half of your army carting wheat and driving oxen just to feed the others, the obvious solution was to figure out a way to force your population to do it for you. And the easiest way to do that was to take the little lumps of gold and silver that soldiers were likely to have looted and pillaged during their campaigns and turn them into coins, which could be swapped with locals for provisions. By demanding that everyone in the empire had to pay their taxes in these coins, governments indebted their subjects, creating a universal need for coinage, which led to the emergence of the first cash-based markets. As a result, in the ancient world, the use of coinage tended to be restricted to areas with lots of soldiers, the capitals and great cities of the empire, and along the imperial frontiers. Other areas kept up the old credit systems. But these were warlike times. The old democracies and republics fell, and the great trading cities were pillaged and destroyed. Coins would be minted to pay the armies, and the armies would reduce thousands into slavery. Slaves would be sent out to work in the mines, providing metal for even more coinage. Before long, large percentages of the population of the Mediterranean cities, India, and China, were made up of chattel slaves. These social and political changes came to affect people's assumptions about what money essentially was. And this, in turn, had profound effects on attitudes toward debt. Because during this period, debt crises continued to occur, just as they had in Mesopotamia, with all their attendant unrest, protest, and even outright insurrection. The constitutions of ancient Athens and ancient Rome both developed immediately out of debt crises of this kind. But where money is considered a real, material thing, and not simply a credit arrangement, not simply a promise, a social relation, then solving a debt crisis by simply canceling debts does not seem like an option. In cities and kingdoms that used coinage, this almost never happened. Instead, the solution, when faced with a debt problem, was to throw money at it. In Athens, there were no debt cancellations. But the democracy came up with endless excuses to distribute coins to its poorer citizens in a kind of reverse taxation. Classicist Richard Seifert again.
It would be a mistake to suppose that the responsibility of the state to maintain its citizens dates from the 20th century. In Athenian democracy, male citizens were paid by the state for various civic activities, sitting on mass juries, manning the fleet, attending the assembly, even for attending the theatre, and they benefited from the distribution of meat in mass sacrifices.
So there was a complex system for channeling wealth from the wealthy to the poor. A crucial mechanism for this was coinage, which enabled the state to deliver lots of money in small portions of equal value. All this was necessary to ensure that citizens didn't slip into penury and debt peonage, which in turn was necessary in order to maintain a population of free citizens available for military service, which could render neighboring peoples into tributaries or slaves. In many ways, the ancient world was a very bleak place. Take, for example, the utterly cynical materialism of ancient authors like Kautilya, who wrote the first manual of Indian statecraft.
The treasury is based upon mining, the army upon the treasury. He who has army and treasury may conquer the whole wide earth.
Such was the philosophy of classical age rulers. This was a period of endless war and brutality, with millions reduced to slavery. One might well wonder why we now see this time as a kind of golden age. But we also have to remember all the great works of poetry, philosophy, and theology this time is also remembered for. It marked the birth, after all, of not only all major schools of philosophy, but also all the world's major religions. These movements were created in self-conscious rejection of this brutal world and everything it stood for. They were, above all, peace movements. As time passed, the great kingdoms of the classical age began to crumble, at least in part due to debt crises. In Rome, India, and China alike, when the empires reached their peak, they made desperate last-ditch efforts to adopt the very popular religious movements that were rallying against them. The Indian Emperor Ashoka became a Buddhist. Constantine adopted Christianity. But it was too late. With their population severely in debt, they lost the ability to recruit troops for their armies, and thus their empires collapsed.